Welcome to Season 3 of the Unscripted Medicine Podcast, a podcast by medical students who live and learn at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine.
On the show, we host a variety of discussions such as navigating the preclinical and clinical years, exploring humanism in medicine, and developing our physician identities outside of the textbook.
Check out the show notes or our website for more information, helpful links, resources, and more.
Please connect with us via email or on Twitter at @unscripted_med. We would love to hear from you. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, my name is Matthew Orshak, and welcome to the Unscripted Medicine Podcast. Today's episode is hosted by M3's Rachel Holloway and Alex Gelati, and will be part of our Clinical Communication Pearls, a series where we sit down with experts to provide students with realistic and practical advice on how to best approach various clinical encounters. Today's episode will discuss how to best take care of patients who are depressed or have suicidal ideations. Unfortunately, it is not uncommon for mental health to be stigmatized in many parts of today's society, so the Unscripted podcast team wanted to sit down with a mental health professional to discuss how we, as medical students, can feel comfortable combating the stigma and broaching these hard yet important conversations with patients. We would like to disclose a trigger warning that this episode does discuss mental illness, specifically depression and suicide, so please, if these topics are triggering for you, go ahead and join us in our next episode. We'll see you then. Our expert today is a board-certified family medicine and psychiatry physician, Dr. Corey Keaton. Dr. Keaton is currently the medical director of the Inpatient Consultation and Liaison Psychiatry Service at the University of Cincinnati Medical Center and is also a learning community preceptor. He earned his medical degree at the Joan C. Edwards School of Medicine at Marshall University and completed his residency in both family medicine and psychiatry at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine. Welcome to the show, Dr. Keaton.
So thank you, Dr. Keaton, for being a guest on our show. To start the conversation for this episode, we were just wondering, if you're walking into a room, how best or what are some ways we could facilitate a safe and comfortable and non-judgmental environment for our patients, especially when it comes to the topic of depression or suicidal ideations and making sure they're comfortable enough to open up to us as providers?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, Alex. So I think part of it is something that's not actually specific to depression or suicide. As a clinician, no matter what specialty we go into, one of our first jobs is when we walk into that room, we want to make sure that our patient's comfortable and that we can ask the questions that we need to ask, and they can give us the information we need in order to kind of help them. Definitely depression and suicidal ideations can be a little trickier because one, it's not something that a lot of people are comfortable asking about. There definitely is a taboo around still mental health amongst patients, amongst providers, amongst the media. So it can be a difficult thing to kind of bring up. So the big thing is you need to be able to build rapport with the patient who's sitting in your office, and you need to build it pretty quickly because you're soon going to be asking them, you know, questions about potentially their deepest, darkest secrets. So there's some easy ways that you can do that anyone can do. One is when you open the door, the first thing out of your mouth shouldn't be medical related, right? So if you think of the last time you were in a doctor's office, how did you feel when the doctor came in and they just started going down a review of systems versus how did you feel when the doctor came in and asked you how you were, you know, how was your family? How were your kids? How's the weather? How was the drive? So the first part of a conversation should not be medical. You're trying to kind of build some rapport and build a human / personal connection with the patient before you delve into kind of those more difficult questions regarding depression or suicidality. So that's the way I typically approach it as the initial go in. And sometimes it can be easier to bring up depression or suicide because that will be like the chief complaint, right? You know, they're there for that kind of stuff. Sometimes it's not. And sometimes it's something that you just find out kind of throughout the course of the interview, both, which are slightly different as far as, you know, how the conversation goes, which I think, you know, we kind of get into a little bit later, but But that's how I start off a conversation, in a very personal, human connection type of way, not medical, because that going in with medical it's risky because it can make people put up their guard, because it's much harder to talk about that medical stuff, especially when you're talking about mental illness.
Absolutely. You know, you think about patients who, or people in general, there are a lot of different signs and clues that someone might be depressed or suicidal. There's, you know, indirect clues, there's body language, there are behavioral clues. And then some people might even, like you said, come in with a chief complaint of depression or suicidal ideations, or just mental health problems. And so you know what you're walking into. So I was just wondering if you could maybe speak to how we can recognize signs and symptoms of depression or suicide in patients who maybe might not be coming in for explicit chief complaints related to mental health.
Yeah, so you're going to have those patients that everyone sees that it's going to be obvious, right? You're going to walk in, they're going to look physically, you know, tired, they're going to seem sad, they're going to be crying. You know, those are the easy ones to pick up because it's pretty right in front of your face. There are more subtle things that sometimes can trigger a provider to think, oh, maybe we're dealing with some mood problems or some depression. It's not always that a person is sad, right? Depression doesn't always equal sadness for a lot of patients. So it's trying to pick up on, like, oh, do they seem more irritable than usual? Do they seem more fatigued? Are they more tired? Are they talking or moving slower than what you have known them to do before? Do they just not seem engaged in a conversation with you? Is it hard to get them to talk and to respond to your questions? All of these things are much easier to pick up if you've seen them before. Mm-hmm. So if you have a good baseline for how they typically function, can be much harder in a new patient to you, which is why it's not only based on kind of observation that you diagnose depression. It's also based on that clinical interview and the questions that you're going to ask. So definitely there's those two groups, the ones that are obvious and then those that are more subtle. And you're really having to use your questions to target depressive symptoms, to kind of tease out who is really suffering from a potential depressive episode or other mental illness, or is this someone's normal? You know, there are those people who, you know, are the Eeyores, you know, of the world, and that is their normal. That doesn't change. That doesn't mean it's pathologic. And it's up to your questions and your interview to try to tease that out. Like, what is something I need to act on versus what is something that is just the person?
Yeah, it sounds like that's really like an art we'll have to master eventually, and kind of practice will make it easier. You mentioned that, you know, like some people's baselines are, you know, like Eeyore, they may not be super happy to begin with. What are some other like common misconceptions revolving like depression and suicide or like suicidal ideations?
Yeah, I think the biggest one is if you're depressed, that means you're sad and you're crying all the time. That's a big misconception regarding depression. There is a big misconception that with depression, you always get kind of hypoactive. So you sleep more, you eat more, you know, or you eat. But that's not always true. There's definitely dysregulation of sleep, but it could be you sleep too much or you don't sleep enough. There definitely is difficulty or changes in appetite, but that could be you eat too much or you don't eat enough. So realizing that there's definitely a spectrum of symptoms when it comes to depression, and it's not a cookie cutter, as with all mental illnesses, actually, it is not cookie cutter. It is very, very patient specific. And one person that you see who is depressed can look very different from someone else who you see as depressed.
Oh. Yeah, that's helpful. And, you know, some people talk about high functioning patients who also have mental health issues. So people who have just like high functioning, you know, I know we're talking about depression specifically in this context, but very interrelated with that is anxiety and other mental health illnesses. And people talk about high functioning anxious people. They are able to utilize their anxiety in order to pump out work and just do 500 things in one day, and no one really notices that they're suffering from anxiety because they're able to kind of channel that into a socially acceptable way. And so I was wondering if you could speak to the questions that are your kind of go-tos to really identify if a patient is depressed or suicidal or suffering from a mental health crisis, because I think that, or at least I would assume that there might be some questions that help you pinpoint that amongst the spectrum of presentations.
Absolutely. I think the easiest one is kind of a learner, kind of the level where you guys are, is using the mnemonic. You know, you have some mnemonics and some things to kind of keep in your memory to trigger, oh, they're depressed, I need to answer these questions. A great mnemonic for anyone who is not only a medical student but early resident is, you know, the Sigi CAPS mnemonic. A great one for depression because it really hits a lot of the big key DSM-5 criteria that you need to diagnose with depression. I typically will go in, you know, kind of soft at the beginning. So, you know, how are you doing? Tell me how you're feeling. How's the last couple of days, last couple of weeks been for you? Trying to get a sense of just their overall functioning, because that's what you really want to get a good sense of, is, like you said, there can be people who are depressed, but who are still able to maintain functioning, right? They're still able to go to work. They're still able to go to dinner with their friends. They're still able to take care of their children and go to class. And that's a different kind of story compared to some people who are no longer functioning. You know, those people who are so depressed, they're not going to work anymore. They're not going to class anymore. They're not leaving their house. So I think first you try to get a good sense of, one, just the mood. How are you feeling? And I like those type of questions more than, are you depressed or are you feeling depressed? It's just kind of it opens it up more for patients to give you more information. So that kind of, how are you feeling? How are things going at home? How's work? You know, when's the last time you got to go out to eat? Just to kind of get a good sense of function, because the function piece is what helps us to differentiate like mild depression versus severe depression, and can give us some insight as far as risk factors for other things like suicidality. So definitely using the Sigi CAPS early on, trying as much as you can just to make it a conversation, make it as natural feeling as you can to get the information that you need. So asking, how you've been feeling, you know, what have you been cooking for dinner, or how many meals have you been cooking these days? What do you like to do for fun? You know, it's a Monday. What did you get to do on Friday night? What were your weekend plans? So making it as much of a conversation as possible, because that's how patients are really going to open up and give you a lot of information. I think another big misconception and thing to remember is patients are at the doctor for a reason. For the most part, they want to talk about this stuff, right? They may not know how to bring it up. They may not be afraid to tell you they're depressed or afraid to, you know, start that conversation. But for the most part, they want to talk about it. So don't be afraid to start initiating that conversation, even if it is as abrupt as, are you feeling depressed or sad? You know, that opens up the door for them. And most patients want to talk about it. Most patients will be very open with you about their symptoms, because a lot of them recognize they're depressed and need help. And that's why they're there. You'll be surprised at how many people come to the doctor for abdominal pain or, you know, shortness of breath or headache or, you know, nausea, when really they're coming for depression, anxiety, mental health reasons. They're just too scared or too embarrassed to say that to the nurse or the scheduler, to put that as their chief complaint. So making sure that as a provider, we just ask the questions. Don't be afraid to ask, because for the most part, they want to tell you and they want you to listen.
Yeah, I feel like that's very reassuring coming from like a medical student perspective, because you just always imagine being in that situation and wondering like, okay, well, if they say yes, what do I do now? And like having to, you know, be mindful that They may be feeling depressed or have suicidal ideations and not wanting to like trigger them or like make anything worse, and then also having to step out of your like comfortability to like broach these topics. So I think that's a really good advice that.
Yeah. 9 times out of 10, it's going to be more uncomfortable for you as a learner than it is going to be for them to talk about it. So yeah, push yourself to do it and yeah, get out of that comfort zone, because that's what they want. That's what they need. And that's for a lot of times why they're there.
And it's better to have that uncomfortable conversation in the office when you can, you know, even if you're asking your attending as a student, or if you are consulting with other attendings as a physician or a resident, you're able to connect them with what they need in the office. Whereas if you just don't speak to it at all, then they go home and they continue to suffer from these mental health crises. And that no one wants that. I do want to, before we move any further forward, yeah. I do want to outline, you mentioned the Siggy Caps mnemonic, and I don't think that you outlined what it was, but I just did a quick search, full disclosure, awesome. And correct me if I'm wrong, but Siggy Caps stands for sleep, interest, guilt, energy, concentration, and appetite, psychomotor, and suicidal ideations. So, okay.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, if they're sleeping more, if they have a loss of interest, an increased sense of guilt, decreased energy, decreased concentration, change in appetite, and then psychomotor symptoms or suicidal ideations.
Yeah. So those are kind of the basic screening questions. That can are the kind of check boxes when you're looking at the DSM as to diagnose a depressive episode. So a lot of us know, you may not know yet, if you don't, you will, the DSM, it really likes check boxes to get diagnostic criteria. So that's how you're going to do it. So you're looking for someone who would screen positive, so have multiple of those different diagnostic criteria positive. They would then screen positive for depression, and that would trigger you or hopefully set off the alarm that, ooh, I need to talk about this more. So the conversation shouldn't stop at the screening questions, right? It's not you should just run through Siggy Caps and then be done with it. That's really a method to trigger you to say, ooh, this person either has or is at risk for depression, and I need to talk more about it.
Right. And these questions are encompassed into like the depression screening, like the PHQ screening. I had a follow-up question, I guess, in regards to that and asking these questions. You mentioned you like to have more open questions like, how are you feeling today? What is your mood like today? Do you do that also with some of these other questions like revolving interest? Because I feel like if you ask patients, have you lost interest in things, they're less likely to be able to maybe accurately answer if they have or have not, versus do you still have like interest in hobbies? Are you still doing those things?
Absolutely. Like for that question. So the way I may approach it is, hey, what do you like to do for fun? And you may say, oh, I really like to watch movies or listen to music. And then you kind of follow it up with, oh, well, when's the last time that you were able to do that? And when you did you enjoy it like usual? Like, you know, how was it? So yeah, you're still trying to hit those points, but in kind of a much less intense, less kind of confrontational way. And that is also something that comes with practice, right? The asking these questions, like that's the psychiatrist like stethoscope and scalpel, right? But that doesn't mean that any clinician can't get good at asking these tough questions. So also don't feel bad if as an early learner, you're having just to go through Siggy Caps, reading them word for word, and in a very checklist format. That's okay. It's just we're using that to then work towards this more kind of conversational kind of assessment and kind of conversational approach to interviews.
So it was mentioned previously that, you know, we sometimes med students feel, and other physicians too, feel uncomfortable asking patients about you know, how they're feeling. Are they feeling depressed? Do they have suicidal ideations? And one of the concerns is possibly, like, one, us feeling uncomfortable, but also possibly, you know, triggering the patient, making their depression worse. Or so I was just wondering, is there anything to keep in mind when talking to someone who is showing signs of depression or suicidal ideation, so that the outcome with you and them is a positive one and not a negative?
I think part of it is allowing them to talk and express whatever they're comfortable with. So these are not interviews that you're really, really pushing hard. Like, tell me, are you depressed? Are you not depressed? Like, how depressed? You know, you're not really pushing, and you're just letting the patient kind of give you what they're comfortable giving. Sometimes you do, though, have to go in hard and ask some really in-your-face kind of questions if you are worried about a patient's safety, because you have, you know, the responsibility to make sure someone is safe. But most of the time, it's letting the patient share what they're comfortable with sharing. Don't push it past that. You know, that will keep a good doctor-patient relationship. That will make them more likely to come back and see you again, more likely to come back and talk more about the issue with you again. So it's building that kind of trust and rapport, that it may take several visits to get the full extent of what the person is going through. And that's okay in most cases, unless you've got an acute safety concern and you really are worried that something bad may happen. So yeah, don't be afraid to ask questions. For the most part, for depression, for suicidality, you're not really going to trigger anything. The biggest risk is asking too many questions too fast and the patient putting up a barrier or putting up a wall because they feel uncomfortable. So it's less about triggering them. It's more about establishing a relationship that allows them to kind of openly communicate with you their symptoms and what they're going through.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think that, I mean, obviously I'm speaking from a medical student's perspective, and I've never experienced it as a physician, but it sounds like creating that safe environment and that trusting relationship in which the patient feels like they can come back to you and speak more to what they're experiencing is just absolutely essential to making sure that they are getting the care that they need. It sounds like there's two kind of buckets that we're talking about. So there's the stable patient who is experiencing depression or depressed thoughts and behaviors and moods, but they're stable. And so, correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Keaton, but the goal of that encounter might be to address their concerns. But if they're not ready to speak to that, if they're not ready to directly address their issues, then we have the ability to let them go, create that open, trusting environment in which they feel comfortable coming back to you and discussing it later on. And then there's this other bucket that is maybe a patient who's a little bit more unstable and who might be having suicidal ideations. And I guess my question for that bucket would almost be, what do you do when you think that a patient might be unstable and you don't feel comfortable sending them home?
Absolutely. I think that's important because it's going to come up, like, and definitely in your career as a medical student, as you know, you're getting into third and fourth year, you're going to see these patients. And I think once a safety concern pops into your mind, once in the midst of a conversation, you have that moment where you're like, you know, I'm worried, then your responsibility is to do an assessment and to ask. Asking someone if they're going to kill themselves could be potentially one of the hardest things that you have to ask someone. It's one of the hardest things to get comfortable with doing. But it's something you have to do because you have to make sure that person's mm-hmm. safe. And there are definitely ways to go about it. 9 times out of 10, I'm not going to just go up to someone and say, hey, are you suicidal? Or, hey, are you going to kill yourself? That's not necessarily the best way to get the information. What you want to try to do, one, is normalize what you think that they're maybe feeling. And then validate any feelings that they're having and attempt as best as you can to empathize with what they're going through. So instead of coming up and saying, you know, hey, Rachel, you seem a little sad. Are you going to kill yourself? It may be a more of a conversation like, hey, Rachel, you know, sometimes when people get really sad or they get depressed, they may have these thoughts, you know, thoughts that are bothersome to them, thoughts that they don't want to be alive or they'd be better off dead or they don't want to wake up. That can be a really normal part of depression. Are you having any of those thoughts? You know, you try to make it as much as a normal part of depression as a disease as possible, because that person is much likely going to disclose to you if they're having any of those thoughts compared to that person where you just come up to them and say, hey, are you going to kill yourself? Or, hey, are you suicidal? That can be a very intense way to ask. And that can set you up to people more minimizing their symptoms and then really not disclosing to you kind of the full truth. So it's about normalizing, showing empathy, and trying to phrase it in a way that I'm asking this because I want to help you, not I'm asking this because you may need to go to the psych hospital, kind of thing. Because it's scary. A lot of people know that if they say these things, they could end up in the psych hospital. And I think all of us have seen movies where the psych hospitals are not depicted in a very positive light. You know, that's definitely not what a true psychiatric experience looks like. You know, it's not One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. It's not, you know, Nurse Ratched. It's not, you know, that stuff. But it's still not usually a very pleasant experience for people. You know, you are kind of, your rights are taken away and you're placed in a facility where you can't leave. So even though it's not what's depicted on TV, it still can be a very stressful and scary thing to consider when you're a patient.
Yeah, you bring up a good point about, you know, being very careful how you frame those questions, because the patient may close down and may not disclose it, and then which ultimately could lead to a negative outcome for them. So it kind of leads to a question, because I know when we approach patients and we tell them like, okay, this stuff is confidential between me and you, unless you're tending to harm yourself or others. I wonder, you know, what's the best way to go about that when interviewing a patient who may be depressed, who you kind of get, you see them, or they are showing signs and symptoms of depression and worrying about whether or not they'll be like truthful with you and open up because you say that, or because of, you know, stigma or fear of being committed, like you said.
Yeah, and I think that can be tricky, right? Because people definitely can minimize things because they don't want their family to know. They don't want to go to the psych hospital. They don't want to, you know, get committed or go to the crazy floor. And letting them know that things are confidential is great, but and also letting them know that you do have a legal responsibility to break confidentiality if you're concerned for someone's safety. And most people are okay with that if you frame it in a way like, hey, I need to call your mom, your husband, your wife, you, and just get some more information on how you're doing. Like, I'm worried about you. You know, if you frame it that way, most people are okay. But sometimes people will still say no. And then there are times where you kind of have to go hardball and you have to say, one, like, are you having suicidal thoughts? Are you going to kill yourself? And then two, I legally have to contact someone now because I'm worried. If you can't give me more information about how you're feeling, then I have no choice. So sometimes you can use it kind of in that way to get actually more information from someone. But you're absolutely right that by law, if there's a concern for safety as a provider, you are responsible for that person, and you have the complete right to break HIPAA, and you can actually contact anyone you want without the person's permission if there's a safety concern and you're attempting to assess for safety. It's not always a fun conversation. Sometimes patients are mad, upset, yelling, screaming at you. You know, it can be challenging, but that's something that you definitely sometimes have to do just to ensure safety.
So in the case where a child is like, having suicidal ideations, you're like able to contact the parents to let them know?
Absolutely. So children under 18, you're definitely protected as far as being able to contact someone, really anyone who you're worried about safety, you're worried about suicide. You're legally allowed to break patient confidentiality, to break HIPAA, and contact someone regarding their safety.
So prior to medical school, I worked in the ED. Prescribed for some providers who saw, obviously, psych complaints. And it seemed to me that there was a distinction between suicidal ideations and patients who had a formulated plan on how to carry out those ideations. And I'm wondering if you can just speak to the difference between suicidal ideations and patients who have a formed plan and how that affects your decision making and your, because we were just talking about HIPAA and, breaking confidentiality in cases where you're concerned for their safety. Is there a difference between just having suicidal ideations, and I say just lightly, but having suicidal ideations versus also having a plan on how to carry out those?
Yeah. And you should definitely think of suicide as kind of a spectrum, a risk spectrum. So it's not really, you shouldn't really think of it as someone suicidal or not suicidal. It should always be, what is their current risk for suicide? Because at any given point, I probably don't have zero risk. You guys may not have zero risk, but it's all about what is their risk of suicide. And that can range from, I feel good about myself, I'm overall happy, I have no morbid thoughts, versus I have some morbid thoughts. So there's something that you may hear a lot when you're seeing notes, reading notes, seeing patients, is this idea of passive suicidal ideations or passive suicidality and kind of morbid thoughts of death. Those are the things that are like, well, maybe it would be better if I just weren't here. Maybe I just don't want to wake up tomorrow. No one would miss me if I were gone. So those are all kind of more passive things. They're morbid thoughts, but there's really no intent and there's no real actionable plan connected with those thoughts. So those are definitely a lesser risk of someone actually completing suicide compared to what they call active suicidal ideations, where it's, I don't want to live and I'm going to do this. Mm-hmm. I don't want to live, so I've hoarded all of my medicines for the last month and I'm going to take them all tonight. So that's a different level of risk. So it's all on a risk spectrum, from no risk to, moderate to high risk with the morbid thoughts of death, passive suicidal ideations, to the very high risk with those active suicidal ideations with intent to do something and a plan to do something. And as far as, when as a provider can you break confidentiality to talk to someone? It is any time that you even question safety. So at any part of that spectrum, if there's a reason for you to question is someone safe or not at home, you're allowed to talk to someone, obtain collateral, and try to clarify, where are they on that risk spectrum? Because no one really is no risk. You can be low risk, but there's no one out there that I would say is probably at no risk.
And as far as the differences in risk go, if you're considering a patient that is quote unquote low risk versus a patient that is high risk, does that impact your plan at all? Or do you typically do the same thing, regardless of the risk level, as long as they have suicidal ideations, you're going to do X, Y, Z?
It changes the plans a little bit. So your biggest job is to come up with a safety plan for all of these patients. And the detail, the level of intensity of that safety plan can vary, depending on their risk. So with the high risk person, it may be admission to psychiatry. Mm-hmm. That's your safety plan. It may be discharge home with 24-hour supervision, spouse, mom, significant others in charge of their medications, remove all sharp objects from the home, So it's the risk tells you to what degree you have to safety plan and how detailed and specific that safety plan needs to be. But all of those patients are getting some sort of safety plan to try to mitigate the risks that are there as much as possible.
So we've been talking about, you know, some of these plans being like admitting the patient into like a psychiatry ward for further evaluation, and how it can make patients feel like, you know, their freedom is being stripped. How do you best go about that without having patients lose their faith in medicine and like make sure that next time they're experiencing these symptoms, because especially if they're diagnosed with depression, it very well may happen again where they may have suicidal ideations, how to make sure they're still willing to seek out care?
Yeah, that's challenging, I think, especially with psychiatry, because we are, you know, a profession that part of our job is in some instances to take away someone's individual rights and place them in a psychiatric hospital and to hold someone basically against their will. So in that setting, when you're actively doing that and that's against someone's wishes, honestly, you're not going to salvage it in that moment, that relationship. But what tends to happen is you're going to work with that person, or psychiatry is going to work with that person through the course of their admission, you know, through their treatment, get them better, get them feeling better. And at the end of the road, you know, at the end of that admission, the patient's going to be able to look back and say, okay, you know, the psychiatrist was doing what they thought they needed to do to save me or to keep me safe, to get me better. And usually once they come out at the end, they're appreciative for what you did. But in that moment, when you're actively like forcing someone to go to the psychiatric hospital, again, you try to reassure them as best you can that you're, you know, you're trying to do this to help them, to keep them safe. But really, for a lot of the cases, it's not worth, you know, trying to salvage the relationship in that moment. You know, that work kind of comes later. And you'll be surprised, actually. People that you say they're going to the psych hospital, they yell, they scream, they cuss, say you're the worst doctor in the world, they're never going to see you again, you're ruining their lives. But those are the people that show up a month later and keep coming back, because a lot of them times they recognize that you care and you were trying to help them.
I feel like that's very comforting as a medical student to know, you know, this whole conversation, because I feel like it doesn't get talked about a lot, just in general in society. And I feel like the stigma we as medical students could play in someone's downward spiral, I think makes students very afraid to bring up this topic with their patients. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate this conversation.
And most of the time, they're already spiraling, right? I mean, and you're the one that's going to try to get them out of the spiral.
Well, wrapping up the episode, Dr. Keaton, do you have any last-minute tips or advice for medical students on how to best approach situations in which they're dealing with mental health crises with their patients, or any perhaps resources that you might direct them to? Any last-minute words of advice?
I think the big thing is don't be afraid to ask questions, and don't be afraid to ask your peers, the residents you're working with, the attendings you're working with, on how they ask questions and how they approach these things. Because everyone will have a little bit of a different approach, but getting to see that is helpful. But also make sure you're asking them too, because of that experience and being able to do it over and over and over again is what's going to increase the comfort. And so it's going to make you good at it. So even though these questions are hard, don't shy away from them. You know, as you guys are rotating, don't just always leave them to the attending or the resident. You know, get in there and kind of ask, because that's what's going to, you know, build up that skill.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Keaton, for all of these pieces of advice. Hopefully students find it helpful upon entering the wards. So thank you.
Sure.